The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for December 14th, 2017, the Devil and Mr. Jones edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I am in Washington, D.C., the Slate studio therein. I'm alone. We were together last week, which means we must be flung apart this week. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine, hello, where are you?
I'm in New Haven, Connecticut. Hello, hello.
John Dickerson of CBS's Face the Nation, where are you?
I'm far flung. I'm in New York City.
Hello, flung. Flung and flung. Flang and flung. On this week's Gabfest, the extraordinary defeat of cartoon villain Roy Moore in the special Senate election in Alabama and what that means for the 2018 election and for President Trump. Then the absurd Republican tax bill is sprinting toward passage. Is there any chance a handful of senators will waver and quaver and decide to kibosh it? Then another week, another round of awful harassing men, sexually misconducting themselves men have been exposed. And this was also the week when the accusations, the many, many accusations against President Trump for his sexual misconduct reemerged and were discussed. We will discuss that and where the Me Too movement is going. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. Doug Jones, prosecutor of the Ku Klux Klan, upstanding citizen, defeated a pedophile creep who believes Muslims shouldn't be allowed to serve in Congress, averred that homosexuality should be a crime, was twice removed from judicial office for violating federal orders. This kind of result should not be a surprise, but of course it was a monumental surprise. Republicans who could have won the Alabama Senate race had they run a bag of wet spinach, had they run Roy Moore's horse, they probably could have gotten 85% of the vote. They found literally the only Republican in the state of Alabama who could lose a Senate seat. They ran him, dragged the president along for the ride. John, I was surprised. Were you?
Well, first of all, they didn't exactly drag the president along for the ride. The president.
I know. What was up with that line?
We gave a full-throated endorsement of Moore, and more to the point, endorsed kind of the entire Moore response to these sexual assault allegations, which Republicans like Mitch McConnell, Mike Lee, Cory Gardner, who runs the senatorial campaign committee for Republicans, all of whom found the accusers more credible than Roy Moore, which means they all believed that he was an assaulter of a 14-year-old girl. So the president didn't just sign on to a candidacy. He signed on to a moral position on something that made people absolutely repulsed. So I was surprised, but not floored. Now, obviously, a year ago, if you'd said a Democrat was going to win in Alabama, you would have been floored. But I think at the end here, I felt like it could go either way. Still, very surprising, just because in this moment of tribalism, and based on all the reporting we'd seen out of Alabama in the strength of Moore's base, my ignorance, but also it's an open question about how it's always an open question about how to whether the Democratic base can be motivated, what motivates the Democratic base, is it successful? That's always kind of a more of an open question than the Republican base. So that's why it was an open question for me going into the election.
Emily, 70% of white Alabama voters who voted for the pedophile. 91% of Republicans who voted in that election voted for the pedophile. Should we be proud of America, or should we merely be slightly relieved that the absolute worst outcome was avoided and that national embarrassment was avoided?
Well, we should be glad that national embarrassment was avoided. Really important to say that the African-American vote was over 90% for Doug Jones. African-American women, I believe, were at like 98%, and turnout was high. And that was especially noteworthy given the various barriers to voting in Alabama. And there's a lawsuit going on right now about the state's voter ID law. And some of the state legislators who backed it were very clear that they were imposing voter ID in order to affect what they called the black power structure in Alabama. In other words, they were trying to make it harder for black people to vote. And in fact, black people are disproportionately affected by this voter ID law. There's a trial about it in February. And obviously, Alabama has a long history of putting up barriers to vote based on race. And yet it is also the site of the Supreme Court decision in Shelby County, Alabama, in which the Supreme Court said that the Justice Department should no longer have a role in pre-approving changes that states make to the voting process. You know, one of the big problems was that the DMV centers in majority black, or I think 75% black counties, were closing down. These are the places where you go to get your identification so that you can vote. Anyway, it seems really important that black turnout was high despite all of that. I was really interested in the gender breakdown. I was surprised at how many women voted for Roy Moore, white women. I probably shouldn't be. I think the it was like 63%, so lower than the white male vote for Roy Moore, but not really that different. And interestingly, younger voters were much more likely to break for Jones than Moore. So that says something about the Republican coalition going forward, right? And this question of whether the Republicans are dominant among groups that are just declining as a share of the population, i.e. old people and white people.
Well, the younger voter in particular, because it matches up with what happened in Virginia. In Alabama, the under 45 vote went to Jones 61-38. In Virginia, for in the governor's race there, it was 64-34. So the problem for it's not just turnout and well done with the ground game for Democrats, but if you're not building support in the next generation as a party, that's a big problem.
John, do you think this is a bullet dodged for the Republicans because they don't now have to endure serving alongside Roy Moore, having him appear in every campaign ad in 2018? Or do you think they'll still end up having to be yoked to him and that he will be a talking point for campaigns in 2018 and 2020?
I think it's a grazing. I don't think it's fully dodged. I mean, yes, they don't have to manage it in the Senate. And yes, the question of whether the accuser should be believed in Roy Moore's case had, of course, a splashback effect on President Trump. Because if your behavior many years ago and credible accusers, I mean, we should note that while the accusations are more severe in the Moore case, there are more people accusing the president and of more recent vintage than in the case of Roy Moore. And so if the senators in the Republican Party thought it was germane to talk about these fewer number of accusers, then why isn't it germane to talk about the larger number of accusers? If the president's argument is, well, people knew about the accusers before the election and they voted for him anyway, then why wouldn't that logic have held if Roy Moore had been elected? So all of those questions are not in the forefront the way they would have been if he'd been elected. But the fact that the Republican National Committee had to choose to support Moore when the head of the Republican Senatorial Committee said he believed that Moore had assaulted a 14-year-old is not a good place to be. It's one thing for Donald Trump to have his views on things. He's got his own political weather that he makes. But the Republican National Committee, the institution that is the head of the Republican Party supporting Roy Moore, is a thing from which it can't necessarily get out from under. And that doesn't mean it's going to be brought up every day, but that's a crack. That's not just you're signing up here not just to support a candidate, but you're making a moral stance. And so that, I think, has some lasting issues. And the real question now, it seems to me, for the Republicans is, what are they going to do in primary races in Nevada and Arizona, where you do have these competitions between, just to use these sloppy terms, more establishment type of Republicans versus more kind of nationalist, Bannon-esque type Republicans. And this is a lesson the Republicans have learned in 2006, 8, 10, 14, that when they nominate candidates who are loved by the primary electorate, they then lose in the general election.
One of the things that we've seen that's so extraordinary is not simply that more demoralized Republican voters who didn't want to vote for a pedophile, but also there is this incredible energy on the left that is very reminiscent of what there was on the right in 2010 with the rise of the Tea Party. I didn't follow this tweet up, but I saw someone tweet that on the same night that Moore lost, the Democrats lost a state Senate seat in Iowa, but the candidate ran 30 points ahead of where Hillary Clinton had run. And so that even in races where Democrats have absolutely no right to be competitive, they are just so incredibly galvanized. So what does that say for the Trump methodology, which is just the base, just the base, just the base?
Well, I think it says that if Democratic turnout is high in 2018, that the Trump-based strategy is going to fail. And if that happens, that will overturn a lot of political assumptions, right? Because the Democrats always have trouble turning out their voters and their base in midterm elections. If Democrats are so angry this year and so determined to reject President Trump and see 2018 as their referendum for doing that, their numbers are higher. You know, and when you look at people who don't normally vote at all, they also tend to skew a little bit toward moderate and liberal positions. And then when you factor in also this tax bill, which we're going to talk about in a minute, which is deeply unpopular, you can see a real like possibility for a broad coalition. And we should note, back to sort of voting rights questions, that the Democrats are going to need that kind of momentum behind them in order to do something like take over the House or even the Senate, given all the barriers to voting and the polarization and gerrymandering.
Right.
So
they need to run.
You have to think.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I think they need to run +8 to take the House, as they are the estimates, which is crazy.
Yeah, exactly. +7 or +8. So right. So that's like the handicap they start with. And that means that it's crazy that it's in reach. And yet in the wake of this Alabama election, suddenly I was seeing people, you know, pollsters saying things like, well, Senate is a toss up in 2018. John, what do you think about all this?
Well, I think we're a long way off. But one thing that is that does seem to be clear from this race and from Virginia is the motivating factor for the Democratic Party is the person in the Oval Office. Obviously, Moore was a special case, but the president was contributory here as well. It's obviously always hard for presidents in the first election after their first term starts, but this one is particularly difficult because it's an identity question for particularly a lot of minorities. They feel a particular threat from the way the president was elected, what he did to President Obama and by being essentially America's number one birther. And that makes the motivation a value motivation. In other words, it's not about policy. It's about who you are. And that obviously in these races has turned out to be powerful enough to get people to turn out to vote. And so that's unlikely to go away as the president is running a presidency that directly challenges those voters on a pretty regular basis.
Emily, I want to close this discussion and hopefully talk of Roy Moore for the last time in my life.
Hey, he hasn't even conceded yet, David. There's going to be a recount. Don't give up.
More. With this amazing data and then the question coming out of it. So evangelical women voted 75% for Moore. Non-evangelical women voters in Alabama voted 75% for Jones. And one reason for this extraordinary divide is a sign of the way in which the cultural issue signaling have become so important. And in particular, the way abortion and life issues have become an organizing principle for many voters on the right. Less so, still very important for voters on the left, but I think incredibly important for voters on the right. Is there any reasonable argument that the left should, for strategic reasons, just try to lose Roe? That Roe should go, and because abortion rights are already so hard to gain in a lot of conservative states anyway. So the access to abortion, many women would be hurt if Roe goes. It would be very bad in a lot of red states. But that the political gain and the counter response that you would get on the left and the way in which you would quiet some of the cultural warriors on the right would be worth it for the left.
So if I was going back to the early 1970s when abortion was kind of quietly on the march in the sense that more and more states were legalizing it, I might choose that path. I would definitely be really interested to see where it goes, whether there's an America in which it's not abortion that is this fundamental divide and people find other ways to organize their political and cultural beliefs. At this point, the idea that we could heal this breach by overturning Roe and going back to state laws, I guess I just really doubt it. I feel like the kind of team thinking and the idea that we're divided by these basic values is too entrenched. But it is true.
Just to interrupt on that. I'm not saying I think the team thinking would remain. It's just that now the team on the left would be the one that would be galvanized and the team on the right would be more quiescent because they would have had their win.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, right. I do think there's this way in which Roe is part of why the Supreme Court in particular works better always as an issue for conservatives. Right. But what you're imagining is a world in which we go to state by state regulation and then certainly you would diminish access for women. It's not good in some red states right now, but there is still an abortion clinic in each state in at least one city, and we would have states without clinics, and we would have big parts of the country. You know, it's whenever I start thinking about this, I wish the country were smaller, because if you were just talking about relatively small geographic distances, you could imagine busing women and girls who need abortions to different states without enormous trouble. But that's not the country we live in. So whenever we go down this road, I start imagining women being forced to have babies they don't want to have. And that makes me upset and nervous. But I do think there is a question about the politics of this and just how corrosive and bad they are for the country and whether there is some way out of them. But what I tend to be drawn to are the idea of restriction on second trimester abortions in states where voters really object as opposed to first trimester restrictions. But then the other thing, sorry, I'm like going back and forth, but I always feel like these questions of compromise don't really solve the problem. And at the end, there is this kind of potential but unlikely kind of mirage-like political gain and a lot of practical suffering that would happen.
That's well put. Mirage-like political gain v. actual suffering. All right, we'll leave it there. We have a Slate Plus segment for our Slate Plus members. Thank you for being Slate Plus members. On Slate Plus today, Emily will tell us about the surprising news that two Trump judicial nominees are being pulled because of recently discovered vile statements that they had made. If you want to hear that extra segment or other extra segments on lots of Slate podcasts, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to sign up for Slate Plus. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu. Congressional Republicans announced Wednesday that they have agreed on a final merge tax bill. They are working to merge this tax bill in a rush for two reasons. First, they are reluctant to expose the bill much to the light of day because the more the public sees of it, the less the public likes it. And second, Doug Jones's victory means that the Republicans' margin for passing the bill in the Senate is effectively down to zero, down to one maybe. And so they're trying to jam it through before Jones is seated and before several, one or more Republican senators has doubts or turns on the bill. So, John, what are the key elements of the unified bill that you've been able to hear about?
Well, they dropped the highest marginal tax rate down to 37. It's currently at 39.6. The corporate tax rate is being dropped from 35% to 21%. And that's, going to be at 20%. The state and local taxes deductibility is at $10,000. I believe the case is that you can deduct, that you can either deduct $10,000 in state and local taxes or in property taxes. Previous versions of the bill had either scrapped the state and local, but capped property at 10. Now you can basically choose between the two. There are deductions for medical expenses and graduate student tuition, and the individual mandate is gone.
Those are gone. Sorry, John. Is the graduate school tuition that's gone?
No,
or that's
they're
back?
Keeping the deductions. You can for still those deduct. Two, is my understanding.
They're keeping it. Okay.
But good. Universities still have to pay taxes on their endowments, I believe.
The individual insurance mandate is gone. The most striking thing to me, and I just do not get the politics of this, dropping the top rate from 39.6 to 7. I mean, sorry, yeah, 39.6 to 37. I mean, they obviously, Republicans have felt nervous about the charge that this is a giveaway to the wealthy at the expense of all that could be done for the middle class and the poor. And then in the face of that, they're cutting the top marginal rate. I don't see why they're doing it. Also, you know, when Marco Rubio asked for an expansion of the child tax credit, which would help the working poor, literally go to the forgotten people that the president pledged his presidency to, they said, no, the corporate rate's got to stay at 20. Got to stay. Can't go a hair above that. And then in order to drop the top marginal rate, they've bumped it up to 21. So you have a direct, I mean, it's not just that they're embracing the critique that this is a benefit to the wealthy over those lower down the income scale, but they then have a specific instance in which changing it to help the working poor was not good enough, but changing it to help the very wealthy was worth changing that corporate tax rate. I don't get that.
So I want to make the obvious point, because I have to make it every time we talk about this tax bill. First, this is not tax reform, which was what we were originally offered or promised. It is quite the reverse. It is being passed in haste. So there will be tons of errors and loopholes in this bill, loopholes that will be exploited, errors that will cause unforeseen impacts and new complexity in the tax code. The tax code is not becoming simpler. It is becoming more complex and possibly ridden with new forms of error and mistake and opportunities for exploitation by canny tax lawyers. Second, as John just pointed out, this is in no sense a huge middle-class tax cut. The overwhelming majority of benefits go to the richest Americans in the form of estate tax gains, corporate profit gains, lower marginal income tax rates, pass-through benefits for people who have pass-through businesses. So, Emily, given that, will the bill be a political dog or not?
I mean, this is the choice. The choice is between the headlines that say Republicans fail again, their donors give up on them, and they have their most ardent supporters say, I don't know why the hell we elected those bums. I turn my backs on them. That's like one set of Christmas New Year's headlines. And the other set are tax bill passes, has a lot of ugliness in it, doesn't look like the middle class really got anything. Gee, if you live in a blue state, you're really screwed. Let me just complain for a moment as a blue state taxpayer how bad this tax bill is going to be for my state. It's going to suck. And it's going to mean that people are paying higher taxes and that the state's budget crisis, which is severe in Connecticut, is going to probably be worsened. So there's a lot to complain about, and there'll be fallout in the way there is for any major piece of legislation, and it will go on for a long time. And so it seems to me that it's a matter of preventing a big short-term blow of failure, but inviting this like piece of unpopular legislation that then Democrats get to hang around the necks of Republicans in 2018.
John, do you think that this is successfully neck hangable? Is this the albatross that they will wear on a chain? Just to tip my hand, I don't think it's going to be a big voting issue. I don't think people are going to feel significant benefits from it, but nor do I think people are going to feel massive costs from it. And I don't think that, even though the polling shows that support is very low for the bill, only 32% support for it, I don't think that necessarily translates into significant electoral gain for Democrats.
I think that's probably right. And to the extent that the left is not outraged about this on a long-term basis the way the right was by the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, in all the problems of healthcare that people didn't like, whether the Affordable Care Act had anything to do with it or not, people kind of put into their animus towards Democrats and President Obama. They also didn't like the sort of big government feel. I think in this case, while this animates underlying and traditional complaints Democrats have about Republicans fully and in new and exciting ways. I think at the end of the day, at the 2018 elections, will be about those the stronger value rejection Democratic voters have, and maybe voters more broadly have, about this president. So this might be a part of that, but I think it will be overwhelmed by all the new things the president does to cause voters to be outraged and work against them. If you look at the generic ballot now, when you ask people just, are you going to vote for a Democrat or a Republican? I believe that the numbers now have Democrats ahead by in the low teens. That's really with a president whose approval rating is in the low 30s to have the generic in the low teens. That's really not good news for Republicans.
And that's with a humming economy also.
Right.
The one thing, though, about the tax bill, just to pop in a moment about the politics of this, it does really give the lie to the populist promise of the Trump presidency for all the reasons we were just talking about, especially given the choice between the Rubio Lee tax relief for the child tax credit versus this lowering of the marginal top rate. And the lowering of the marginal top rate is exactly supply side trickle down economics, right? It's not even like, oh, it's going to be different this time because it's corporations getting the tax cut. It is simply for the richest people.
Yeah.
The middle class tax cut, right. So there's, and the child tax credit is not the only thing they could have done. I mean, there's expansion of the ITC to childless couples.
Sure.
They could have changed the rates for middle class. So there's a lot of things they could have done if they wanted to take the money available that they're spending here and channel it directly so that everybody in the middle class, everybody in the class of people the president referred to as the forgotten men and women, that everybody would get something. The way the theory now works is that they will get something. It won't be an overwhelming amount and it'll taper off, but then they will get this benefit from increased jobs and plants and equipment and all that. Well, so obviously there's a lot of debate about whether that will actually happen and if corporations will do that. But let's imagine even that they do. You've got to work for the right corporation and in the right place for it to be a broadly shared benefit to the middle class. So that's the big difference. And also when you're spending money on plants and equipment, you know, there are a lot of economists who believe that's not, yeah, the plants and equipment they're going to spend their money on is going to be robots and not new employees.
It is amazing how this has revealed, although I suppose we already knew this, but it's amazing how it has revealed that the Republican Party has one basic idea, which is that we want to offer tax cuts for rich people, even when it goes against economic principles they've espoused for years, even when it goes against the interests of the people who voted for them, even when it goes against the very thing the president at the top of their party espouses. It's a kind of extraordinary how dominant this single idea is. And it's also extraordinary how corrupting it is for intellectual integrity. It is very disappointing to me how intellectually dishonest the arguments in favor of this bill have been. There's not a single genuine economist of any note who thinks this will not bust the budget, who thinks it will lower the deficit. Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, has relied on absolutely laughable pipe dream growth projections to justify supporting this bill.
And he's being investigated because he claimed to have an analysis that the Treasury Department never performed.
Yeah. There's no price, though, that is being paid for this nonsense economics. And it's really just disappointing. This is not a moment when the country needs a huge tax cut. And to do this and to do it in the way they're doing it is weird and sad. And it's going to come through riddled with errors because of the way it's being drafted. Errors that will be billions of dollars in someone's favor or cost someone billions of dollars. And it doesn't have to be this way. It's so frustrating.
Can I ask a question about the end of the Obamacare mandate? So in previous versions of healthcare reform, which did not pass, voters seemed quite exercised about the notion of millions of people losing their healthcare insurance. It seems entirely possible and likely that that is going to happen from the end of the mandate. It may not be 13 million the way CBO projected, but it seems like it's going to be a lot of people and that it undermines the structure of the healthcare bill. If that takes place and we see people getting kicked off the rolls and we see premium pricing go up as, you know, we go into the kind of spiral that happens when the insurance pool shrinks and healthy people leave, the people who, you know, were probably pushed into buying healthcare because of the mandate. Like, does that have a political effect that we think we will see?
It depends how much, you know, that gets into the public's consciousness. You see at the moment the point you led with, which was that the people who will lose coverage or who will choose not to have coverage because there's no penalty for the mandate. You've seen that be less a part of the conversation here than it was at the time when healthcare was the only issue. So I think for Democratic voters, it will be pretty obvious. And that's something that they, because of its association with President Obama, that will be, I think that will be motivating for them. I think if you're a Republican, you still have to campaign on removing Obamacare. The interesting thing for me to watch is they're going to attach, in the Senate at least, the Alexander Murray. That bill takes measures to strengthen the Affordable Care Act, and you have a lot of Republicans who don't want to take such measures because implicit in that is that the Affordable Care Act stays alive.
Last question on this bill, John. Is there any chance that it doesn't get through? Is there any chance that they don't actually have the votes in the Senate to get it through, or that the whole California delegation bolts because of how state and local taxes are being treated? Or does the fact that they've announced this conference bill mean that it's locked up?
Well, there's probably a slim chance once we see the actual language and you know, there might be something funny in there. But I don't think so. I think it's going to go forward. Collins, Flake, Rubio, and even Marco Rubio, he sent a couple of tweets, but nobody takes that seriously as a, or nobody I've talked to, I should say, takes that seriously as any threat to the actual bill. Susan Collins seems to be on board, so I think it's heading to be signed.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest, biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
What men are down this week? Starting to lose track of it. Mario Batali, the celebrity chef, accused of rampant sexual misconduct. Russell Simmons, the music mogul, accused by three women of rape. Tavis Smiley of BET's program has been put on hold by PBS. There's another New York restaurateur, a big New York restaurateur, who's been pilloried. New Yorker's chief political writer was forced out amid mysterious allegations. It's just crazy. But most notably this week was a resurfacing of the allegations against President Trump. Three of his many accusers went on Megyn Kelly's show to talk about their experience with him. The Atlantic published an annotated list of the 19 different women who accused him of sexual misconduct. So there are two, I think, big questions that emerged this week, Emily. One is, what is to be done about the allegations against the president, if anything? And two, where is this movement heading? So let's start with the Trump accusations. They're super disturbing. I had forgotten them for the most part. I knew they were there, but I'd forgotten the specifics. But there are feelings.
But when one gets dragged into the specifics, they're really yucky.
They're really yucky. So they range from, you know, unforcible, unwanted kissing and grabbing and to walking in on pageant contestants naked, feeling women up, breasts and through their underwear. And Trump's response has been, essentially, these are all lies. So.
Well, also, he said he didn't know the women, which wasn't true, since we have pictures of him with some of them.
Yes, that is also true.
Although,
so,
you know, it's just one little thing. This is not to excuse that. But he has a very interesting tick that he has about any criticism, not just in this instance, but all, is that he often says about people he's met that I don't know them. They don't know me. In other words, as if they have no standing to make the claim. But the standing is the depth of knowledge is irrespective of standing. But this is something that is a thing that he does in a lot of different other circumstances.
because he's
a liar.
I would
say that that makes it more rather than less disturbing.
But yeah, yes, that's why right, I started by saying this doesn't excuse him.
yes, fair enough.
For fear of that rebuttal.
So, gotcha. Emily, what is to be done?
What is to be done? Well, I mean, Senator Gillibrand called for hearings this week. It's hard to imagine that that will actually happen. It was really interesting that Nikki Haley talked about how these women should be heard. They are being heard. Some of them went on Megyn Kelly's show this week. I think we're going to have another round of media coverage, and we already are having that. But it is really difficult to figure out how there could be some actual consequence. So then you have this contradiction we all keep noticing, which is that other men around the country are losing their jobs and getting in big trouble for less egregious conduct than the president is credibly accused of. I mean, obviously, Al Franken, we should note, he resigned, I think, after we taped our last show, like right after. And he said, I note that I'm leaving. Even though I deny some of these accusations against me and the president is accused of much worse. So anyway, so we have this contradiction of men around the country losing their jobs. Some of the allegations against them are less serious, and there certainly are fewer women involved than the accusations against President Trump, whose job does not look at all in jeopardy.
Almost everyone else has a boss. They have a board. They have shareholders. There's some clear institutional mechanism for removing them from their position. The president, there is a mechanism for removing him from his position, which is impeachment, but it's not, it's very different to impeach the president than it is to fire the CEO of a company. One is disruptive for shareholders. The other is a monumental disruption for the nation and the world. So given that, given
and
that
they're anti-democratic by nature, right?
So given that there doesn't appear to be a clear, obvious, natural mechanism for doing anything about it, therefore should nothing be done about it? It's kind of where I've come down. Is that it's good to publicize it. It's good to talk about it. I don't know that there's any gain to get from congressional investigations, and there's nothing to be done. And so to hope that something can be done is hopeless.
Emily, what do you make of Trey Gowdy's argument in dismissing calls that he should look into this, said this is a criminal matter and should be brought up in the criminal courts? I mean, obviously, that can be seen as buck passing, but is there a what did you make of that?
I mean, I think it would be very hard to bring criminal charges against President Trump at this point for these allegations. They are like, you know, misdemeanor assault in the third degree, or this. It just they're not the kind of allegations that many years later people are normally prosecuted for.
Right, and they're also not they're beyond the statute of limitations in almost every case, I think. Am I right about
Probably.
That?
Probably. Yeah. I mean, look, Harvey Weinstein still hasn't been prosecuted, and there are very credible rape allegations against him in numerous cities and states. So the notion that Trump is going to be prosecuted
seems, I think,
Trey Gowdy doesn't want to deal with this.
But also, I don't think that Gowdy is wrong to say this isn't the job of Congress. Congress's job is to investigate and have oversight over what the government does and to be a check on the executive branch. None of this has anything to do with allegations about misbehavior by the president as president. And none of it has to do with him being what he's done in office or has any policy implications. And so it's disturbing and disgusting and wrong. And he's a lecherous, disgusting, predatory creep, which we knew when he was elected. But I don't therefore think that the government has any work to do to try to accomplish anything about that.
Right. It does seem really important, obviously, that the voters knew about this before they elected him. One thing that's been striking to me is listening again to the Access Hollywood tape, to what Trump said to Billy Bush that day in the wake of all of this wave of topplings and the Me Too movement. It sounds worse to me. I mean, it didn't sound good at the time, but I actually was shocked to hear it again. It just is so predatory.
You're right. But David's point is hard to assail.
We do have this lawsuit against the president for defamation brought by one of the women. So it'll be interesting to see if that goes far enough to get some discovery.
Do you think that'll... So is that like, Emily, the Paula Jones case where essentially they put it off saying that this... You can't sue a president because it gets in the way of his duties. And then Bill Clinton had to pay $850,000. Is that a model for what's happening here?
Yeah. And in fact, the Supreme Court said that that suit could go forward. I mean, that, you know, this idea that like the president can't be distracted, the Supreme Court rejected that logic. And so, yes, that suit should go forward based on the same reasoning. And it will be interesting to see if a similar settlement ensues or if this plaintiff, like I said, gets some information in the discovery process.
Let's turn just to the other part of this, which is the this week in Awful Men. Emily, do you get the sense that this movement is just going to continue kind of as is forever? Or are we going to – is it going to end in a moment? Is it going to end with a false accusation and people will suddenly be full of doubt and now men will be again allowed to get away with whatever they want to get away with because there was one false accusation. What do you think is likely to happen? How is this going to unfold?
Well, I think the really interesting question is, how could the workplace change? What would it take? What do women really want from the workplace that is not true now? And will men be scared enough to change their behavior, right? I mean, that it looks like for the first time, there are real consequences for lots of people who didn't expect to face those consequences. And so other men and boys growing up seeing that could think that they were really going to pay a price in a way that they didn't before. I mean, this is something that we've seen a little bit with the movement against campus sexual assault, that, you know, boys in high school, at least my kids, have a much more robust sense of risk to them than I think that certainly like the boys and men I grew up with had. So that I think is really interesting. And then I also wonder if, you know, women are radicalized in a way that will make people call out bad behavior and refuse to sort of go along with it in a way that we just didn't see in previous generations. And one thing I find myself like in some ways all over the map on this issue. I've gotten really concerned about due process in some of these cases. You know, the fact that all those senators called for Al Franken to resign before there was any kind of ethics investigation, that worried me. On the other hand, when Franken did go ahead and resign, that meant that, like, I mean, what were we supposed to make of that? That his position really in the Senate was untenable, or that he was trying to stave off what we would have found out? I mean, he denied some of the allegations, but that was confusing. And I don't like the idea of due process kind of going entirely by the wayside in all of this. But on the other hand, I do think that, like, it is the moment for a reckoning and that there are a lot of things about the workplace that don't succeed for women. And it is a big relief to see all of that aired and taken seriously in a way that, like, just has not happened before.
I think the closest thing I can think on this is the movement against drunk driving, where in a very rapid moment, because of, I mean, it was a different source. In this case, it was a source of mothers. It was MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Right.
Drunk driving went from being basically socially acceptable to being completely socially unacceptable. Not that it never happens anymore. It certainly happens a lot. But it the rates went down precipitously, and it was socially stigmatized in a wonderful way. And I think that we're probably having that moment with sexual misconduct in the workplace.
Well, that's a really positive analogy because drunk driving fatalities also went way down.
Right. I think the interesting border, I think the interesting location of where ambiguity is going to be is the consensual relationship with a person who is your junior in the workplace. And that's where people's uncertainty is. Almost every bit of what we've learned so far has been really grotesque predatory behavior that no one can excuse. But I think where people are unsure is, you know, if somebody has an affair with somebody who works for them or is their junior, is that now totally unacceptable? And that's one place where I think people don't have an answer, that they have an answer about Harvey Weinstein. They have an answer about, you know, groping people. They don't necessarily have an answer about that.
Right. So Allison Benedict, who's a colleague of ours at Slate, wrote, I thought, a really thoughtful piece about office flirtation. And she was talking about her relationship with her husband, which started as an office flirtation when he was like essentially her supervisor or had some kind of supervisory authority over her. And of course, like, they've been married for years and she's glad that he expressed his interest in her. I got to the end of the piece and I, like I said, I can like find something to sympathize with in basically every viewpoint that women are expressing right now. But I did wonder, okay, so is it really true that we are risking a world in which men don't make passes? Or is it just that like they would be more careful? And that if you're the supervisor of a woman you're interested in, you would really, really make sure that she wanted you to kiss her before you tried? And like, how terrible would that really be? What do you guys think about that?
I don't think it would be that terrible for us to have to really give up the idea in most cases that there can be good consensual relationships among people working together in an office of different rank. That is a thing which in individual cases is really nice. And we can all think of great examples of people who met their spouse because one of them was supervising the other. And those are lovely, but it is somewhat problematic. And so if we can make those at least slightly more difficult, slightly more cumbersome, put sort of official barriers in the way of it, that's probably to the good in the long run.
Right. It's like proceed with caution, essentially. And I guess I assume that human nature and people's interest in romance and sex and their desire will surmount, right? And that they're not going to like not find each other. But I don't know. Maybe there are people who feel like that's not that that is a real risk.
Well, workplaces are great because you're working, you tend to work with people, you spend a lot of time with them, you see them accomplishing things and often at their best selves. It's a shame to fully give that up as a
yes.
source of romance and potential marriage. But
here's another thing I've been wrestling with. Some of these men, I feel like, deserve some sanction, but not to be fired. And I can't decide like if the rank humiliation of being on this list is enough in itself or kind of what to do with people who are there are a few of them in public radio. So, for example, Tom Ashbrook, who's the host of On Point, was accused of giving unwanted hugs and back rubs to women in his office. Like, maybe there will be more to those allegations. I don't know. But if you just take that on its face, that seems to me like, okay, he should stop. Like, he should not make women uncomfortable in his office, for sure. But I don't think he should be fired for that. That just seems like the kind of insensitive behavior that you could get someone to desist from without necessarily making them lose their job. And I'm starting to wonder about that middle ground. There are people who are being who are under investigation and kind of suspended or not at work while they're being investigated. But, you know, what happens when those investigations are over? Do some of them get to come back? And like, can we figure out some kind of interim sanction here so that we're not talking about like lifetime banishment for every single man who's accused of doing something untoward?
I do wonder, Hannah and I were talking about this morning, whether there's going to be kind of a scarlet H for people, which will make them unemployable almost. I've very successfully and with great glee and delight hired people who'd sinned, who'd committed sins. and in every case, I have been totally thrilled by that hire, that these were people who were motivated to work really hard and had, you know, they'd made mistakes. They'd made honest mistakes and they had paid for those mistakes. They'd lost jobs. They'd been humiliated. And I was glad to have them. And in all cases turned out to be wonderful colleagues. But I don't know. I don't think I would hire such a person at this point.
Forever, though?
I don't know.
Like, I feel like it's, we can't. I know that a lot of women feel very frustrated that attention is going into worrying about these men because obviously there have been women who've been sidelined.
Point. Very good
right?
point.
No, really, like it's a real concern.
Yep.
Like we have lost, right? I like want to pay tribute to that. It is real. On the other hand, in a court of law, when you punish someone, you decide on their sentence at the outset. That's like part of due process, and everyone abides by that. And most of the time, we don't give people the death penalty or life in prison. We come up with other sorts of sanctions. In this case, in the court of public opinion, we don't have a very clear way of distinguishing between large and small infractions. I don't even think we agree about what those were. I mean, some people listening may think that, you know, unwanted hugs and back rubs are terrible. And it's so hard to know because you don't really get from like the words of the news account the impact that the behavior had on women in the workplace and how much it caused people to leave or be sidelined or discriminated against. I find wrestling with all that very tricky because I sort of do want to make sure that there are like interim sanctions and that we know what they are up front. And yet there is like no real way to do that. And I do appreciate that what happens to these men is not like necessarily the primary concern right now.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
And now let's go to cocktail chatter. Emily Bazelon, when you're having a vodka and soda, which was the drink in the New Yorker viral short story, Cat Person.
which we're not talking about today, I wanted to.
Every other podcast in America has talked about it. What will you be chattering about with your vodka and soda?
One of the fascinating things to me about the Trump administration is watching mainstream nonpartisan organizations perform, if not radical, at least more assertive roles. And one of those organizations is the American Bar Association, which has declared a couple of Trump's judicial nominees unqualified. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes for Slate Plus. But the ABA did something else interesting this week. It sent a letter to Attorney General Jeff Sessions pointing out that of the 57 candidates for U.S. attorney that the Trump administration has so far announced, only one of them is African American, and only three are women. That does not reflect the composition of the country nor of the legal profession. It is still true that the profession is majority male and majority white, but it is not that skewed. And equal numbers of men and women are graduating from law school these days. So I just thought this was a kind of amazing document that the ABA would feel that these top prosecutor federal prosecutor positions in the country are so imbalanced that it would try to speak out. And of course, reflects other aspects of the Trump administration in terms of how heavily white and male it is. And I wonder if there will be any response at all to this letter.
That is demoralizing, although not, I suppose, entirely surprising given this administration. But it is demoralizing. John, what is your chatter?
My chatter is just a recommendation that everybody go watch The Post when it comes out. I got a chance to watch it in advance of doing an interview about it for CBS This Morning. And there are so it's a great story, obviously, about The Washington Post and the battle over to catch up with The New York Times, which broke the story of the Pentagon Papers. But there it's got Meryl Streep playing Katharine Graham. An amazing moment, particularly in the moment we're in now and a lot of the issues we're talking about. The Katharine Graham coming from being the widow of the former publisher of The Washington Post, coming into her own at this important time for The Washington Post. There's that great story, that great piece of acting. Then you have Tom Hanks playing Ben Bradley, this kind of pirate editor, which is another great piece of acting and another interesting character in history in that time. But then the relationship between the two of them is also its own little storyline, which is just great. And there's a scene early on in the movie that I won't ruin, but it's such a great scene. And a delicate, like just of the small, little, tiny brush strokes of acting and the pair between the two of them. So even if you weren't there for the great narrative and story about journalism during, you know, and the systematic disinformation campaign from multiple administrations about Vietnam, there's just the straight up good acting.
My chatter this week is about a wonderful bot project that was carried out by Botnik.org. Botnik.org, which I don't quite understand, is an organization. It's a creative arts collective that uses computer algorithms and bots along with human intervention to create interesting creative projects. And what they did is they used what's called their predictive typewriter, which is something where there's a human kind of start sentences and then computers finish them. And these computers have read all of Harry Potter to create a new Harry Potter chapter in a book titled Harry Potter and the Portrait of What Looked Like a Large Pile of Ash. This chapter
Where did the title come from? That's awesome.
It's the bot. And the
I love it.
The chapter is so funny. It's so extremely funny. It's just every bit of
choice lines.
Yes, every bit of it is. The castle ground snarled with a wave of magically magnified wind. The sky outside was a great black ceiling, which was full of blood. The only sounds drifting from Hagrid's hut were the disdainful shrieks of his own furniture. Magic. It was something that Harry Potter thought was very good. Where the Death Eaters said these... let me find some of the good lines here. Voldemort, you're a very bad and mean wizard, Harry savagely said. Hermione nodded encouragingly. The tall Death Eater was wearing a shirt that said, Hermione has forgotten how to dance. So Hermione dipped his face in mud. It's just extremely Dada. It's so Dada. The great hall was filled with incredible moaning chandeliers and a large librarian who had decorated the sinks with books about masonry. Mountains of mice exploded. Several long pumpkins fell out of McGonagall. Dumbledore's hair scooted next to Hermione as Dumbledore arrived at school. Anyway, it just goes on and on in this extremely Dada way. It's delightful.
I want to recommend the new Slate podcast, Slow Burn. It's a podcast about Watergate over 8 episodes in a kind of mini series. And it tries to answer the question, what was it actually like to live through this evolving story as this crazy burglary in Watergate, this evolving scandal that went from a crazy burglary in the Watergate Hotel to bringing down President Nixon. I listened to the first episode with great enjoyment. It's about Martha Mitchell, a character who had been lost to history, at least to me, and who's one of those people who kind of enters the scene and is totally intriguing, and you get very caught up in exactly how she factored into Watergate, and it's then amazing that you've never heard of her before. And I thought Leanne Nafak, who is a terrific Slate reporter, was a great storyteller, so I recommend the show.
Our show is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Izzy Rode. You should follow us on Twitter at Slate Gabfest, the good Twitter feed, and it will keep you up to date on things. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, who am I? Let me think for a second. I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next, and I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.